The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right, welcome to a Monday. Yeah, we made it through the weekend, and it was a rough weekend, too. I hope you took my advice on Friday and did something that warms your heart and your mind. It was tough reliving, 20 years ago. I know for me, it seems like it was yesterday, but, you know, we're old. or speak for myself, I'm old. And so, I remember it so clearly. Like it was yesterday, those images and rewatching them just brought back those old horrible feelings. So I took my advice, and on Apple television, I watched the Broadway production of Come From Away. And as I told you on Friday, I've never seen it. I haven't been out to a Broadway show or to any kind of show in over 18 months now. But, except we did go to the Van Gogh thing in like the little window where we thought it was safe to go out. Still wore a mask, though. But they filmed this on Broadway right when Broadway reopened. So this is a very recent production. In fact, you see the audience coming into the theater all wearing masks. And I got to tell you, it was every bit as heartwarming as I thought it would be. I had mentioned, in case you weren't here on Friday, I had mentioned that I had read a book written by a friend of mine, a former coworker, Jim Defeaty, called The Day the World Came to Town. And it's about what happened in this little town of Gander, Newfoundland. I thought it was Newfoundland, but watching the show, I learned it was Newfoundland. So Jim's book just so blew my mind and stayed with me all these years. And then a few years later, I heard about this Broadway show, and it's like the people of Gander, Newfoundland, and how they took care of these thousands of international travelers whose planes all descended on their little airport because everybody, you know, the skies were shut down after the 9/11 attacks. And you know, I know Jim's book, but I didn't know the musical, and they work beautifully together. Jim Defeaty will join us, I believe, a week from today. We'll talk about everything from Miami politics, because he is a reporter down here in South Florida. That's his day job. He wrote this book after 9/11 because he had heard about the hospitality of the people in Gander, and he wrote an amazing book about it. So Gander, Newfoundland. No, Terrence in the chat room is saying Gander, Newfoundland. I thought it was Newfoundland. I got to go back and watch it again now. Maybe it was Newfoundland. I don't know. I don't know. It's how they pronounce it, because they talk kind of funny up there, you know? Okay, before we get into anything else, I need to issue a correction. I need a sounder. There's a great song by an artist named Keb Moe that goes, "I was wrong, please forgive me." You don't want me to sing, but I was wrong. I was wrong. I got something really wrong last week. On Thursday, I believe I said it. And I hope nothing I ever say would cause anybody not to vote. And what I said mistakenly, the current frame rate is too high. How do I do what? All right, something funky is going on with my thing here. Now, my frame rate is not too high. It is not. All right, I'm just talking back to YouTube here. Anyway, so I was wrong. Last week I told you I had read somewhere, and this is what I get for reading too much, I guess. I read somewhere that with this recall election, you know, everything is kind of foobar. It's all just wrong, frankly. It's wrong. But that everything had to be in. Like the only ballots that were going to be counted were the ones that were in by the end of voting tomorrow. Tomorrow's election day in California, September 14th. Well, disregard whatever I said last week, because I was wrong. And now, hold on. Now, I closed this window and now I can't open it again. God, it figures today's the day the gremlins are out. right? All right. But I want to read this email. Okay. So Dorit from Los Angeles sent me an email that I got on Saturday. And she said, Dorit? I don't know. They said, I'm a longtime fan of yours. Listen to you until you moved to a different time. So now I listen to the previous shows on YouTube. Well, cool. That's what, you know, YouTube is there for. They wrote, today I listened to your Thursday show in which you said that it's too late to mail recall ballots. As an LA resident who's terrified of possibly having Larry Elder as our governor, I feel compelled to correct you because I'm afraid you may have discouraged some California voters from voting if they had planned to vote by mail. No! Sorry. Well, all I was saying, I didn't never meant to infer that anybody shouldn't vote. What I was saying is hand deliver it. But I was wrong. And Dorit's not the only person who told me, a few others did as well, that as long as it's postmarked by tomorrow, you're good. I personally wouldn't chance it. I don't trust the mail service. Thank you, Louis DeJoy. Thank you, former guy. I would hand deliver it, but whatever. Don't, if the only way you have to get your ballot in is to mail it, just make sure it's to the post office by tomorrow. Dorit continues, here's the wording on the instructions enclosed with the ballot. Quote, mail your ballot so it is postmarked on or before Election Day and receive no later than 7 days after Election Day. I'm Nicole Sandler. I was wrong. So, yes, mail it. And the email continues. Although the polls are looking favorable for Newsom right now, we who don't want Newsom recalled can't take anything for granted. And we don't want to send an undeniable, overwhelming message to the Republicans. My hope is that you'll correct the voting information on your Monday show. Yes. Thank you. If you've already learned you were incorrect and said so on your Friday show, please forgive me for wasting your time. Let me tell you this, Dorit, and the other people who corrected me. You're never wasting my time. If I get something wrong, that's like the original sin. That's the last thing I want to do. So if I get something wrong, correct me. Call into the show. 954-889-6410. If I don't answer, you can even text that number and send me a message. Email me, Nicole@NicoleSandler.com. Tweet me @NicoleSandler. Put it on Facebook. These are all places I look. Go into the chat room. Tell me if I got something wrong. Because unlike the idiots on Fox or right-wing hate talk radio, the last thing I want to do is give out wrong information. I have opinions, but I want even my opinions to be correct. I know sometimes you may disagree with my opinions, but at least for me, that has to be my truth. But my truth, my opinion, has nothing to do with fact. Although I try to base my opinions in fact. Am I talking myself in circles here? You get what I'm saying, right? If I make a factual error, tell me so I can correct it. Because the last thing I want to do is put out bad information. So, I guess we should have like a corrections or a red pen segment of the show. So anytime I get something wrong, you let me know. Newfoundland. No, now people in the chat room are saying, you know what? I'm going to bring it up. I don't think I could bring up Apple TV on here. I'm going to watch it again tonight. I will pull out the pronunciation, the correct pronunciation of either Newfoundland or Newfoundland. I think it's Newfoundland is how they said it. But I don't want to be wrong. So I will double check it tonight and I will do the proper pronunciation for you tomorrow. Or you know what? I bet I can do it this way because this is one of my favorite toys on the internet. How to pronounce Newfoundland. I think it's Newfoundland. Let's see. Here we go. All right. Play it. Can we say, oh, no, that's slow. All right, so why isn't it playing?
Newfoundland.
Newfoundland? What?
Newfoundland.
Well, I don't think that's right, electronic lady.
Newfoundland.
Newfoundland? I don't know. That's that's not right. What is this person saying? Let's try this one. Okay, you.
Writing's not.
Oh, that's a commercial. I don't want to hear your commercial. Just I want to hear how they pronounce Newfoundland.
It was in 1876, deep in the heart of the American Old West, that John Peter Davis ended an argument by whipping out his...
What is this? This is... No. Okay.
Newfoundland.
Newfoundland. See?
This is the standard.
He just said
several ways to do it.
Okay.
Newfoundland.
Newfoundland.
This is the standard, the one on CBC, the one you'll hear pronounced by any Newfoundlander after 1970.
Okay.
You can pick Newfoundland or Newfoundland. Newfoundland.
Newfoundland.
The full name of Canada's 10th province, of course, has been Newfoundland and Labrador since 2001.
Newfoundland and Labrador.
For the same time, locals have started mushing the words together.
Newfoundland.
Newfoundland. This is the version that was personally approved by Joey Smallwood, the iron-fisted first premier of Newfoundland.
More info than you ever wanted to know.
Mule. That was actually quite common among English speakers of the time. But today, this is almost exclusively the old people pronunciation.
All right, we heard enough, right? You heard enough? Newfoundland. Newfoundland. All right. I was right. Newfoundland. If you say any word that you take and you say over and over again, starts sounding really weird to you. But Newfoundland, that's how they said it in the show that I watched on Friday night, Saturday morning, whatever the hell it was. Newfoundland. Can I tell you what else is wrong? Yes? What do they call people from Newfoundland? Newfoundlanders. Newfoundlanders. What? Newfies. Yes, they do, actually. Newfies. Nothing to do with roofies, mind you. But, you know, just saying. Watch the show. You'll see that they don't even know from roofies. They're just all nice. They're just nice. They're endemically nice. Okay. Let me tell you what's happening today. So Katrina Vandenhoevel will join us. And if you don't know Katrina, well, today's a good day to get to know her because we're just going to have a conversation. She is the publisher of The Nation magazine, and now she is the editorial director, I think is her official title. She was editor until about 2 years ago when she stepped down from that position. She's still the publisher of the paper and has been. She's been at The Nation forever. She really started there. I think she left for a little while and came back, but really she worked her way up to become editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. And she's been writing. She writes a weekly column, an op-ed in, why is YouTube frozen? Oh, there we go. In the Washington Post. And I've noticed that over the last few weeks, you know, she commented on the end of the war in Afghanistan, which, of course, The Nation for all these years has been strongly against. They have the new print copy of The Nation is all about, you know, the last 20 years. In fact, the cover story, what does it say? 20 years of bloodshed and delusion. So that's sort of the jumping off point for the conversation with Katrina Vandenhoevel. Just so you know, we had to tape it about 2 hours ago because her schedule this afternoon didn't permit her coming on live. So I can tell you it's a wide-ranging conversation about everything. But I think you'll get a good insight into Katrina, and I really enjoyed it. We could have kept going for an hour or more. But so she'll join us at the bottom of the hour. Okay, so let's see. I was going to tell you about some other things that are just plain wrong. I said I was wrong. I was wrong in one manner. I got bad information that I attempted to correct immediately. Let me tell you who else is wrong. The feminine voice pronunciation is correct for me. I think that is the person who wrote the letter. And then this person says, no, 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 the guy is wrong. I've heard it many times from people who live there. Newfoundland. Newfoundland. Right, that's what I said, Newfoundland. Okay. Anyway, I'm done with Newfoundland for now until Jim joins us next week. I see. He was talking about the pronunciation of Newfoundland, not the name of the person who wrote into me. It's Monday. I'm already like, oy. All right, but I wanted to tell you about Florida. I know I could do this every day. I could bore you with stories of the stupidity in the state where I live, and I'm convinced it's not the heat, it's the humidity. Florida. That's our theme song. So our governor is just, I don't know what's wrong with him. There's something seriously wrong with him. He wants to be Donald Trump, and he emulates him in every way possible, from lying with every breath he takes to being just an asshole, like a really certified fucking asshole, like as horrible as they get. So let me share with you. Okay, that's not the right thing. Come on. Okay, it should be in this. Why am I not finding? All right, hold on. We got somebody calling in. Hi, who's this? Well, I look for the video I'm looking for. Hello?
Yeah, hi, Nicole.
Hi.
Testing 1, 2, 3. Yeah, Nicole.
Yes.
Look, I can see Canada from my house. It's Newfoundland.
Newfoundland. Newfoundland.
Regarded as newfies.
Right. I got the newfies part, as opposed to roofies.
Because I used to play in a punk rock band with a friend of mine. He's since passed, but his name was Junior. He was from Newfoundland.
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 Newfoundland. That's what
just,
I said.
Just say it in one breath.
Newfoundland.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Who's this?
Yeah,
Who is this?
Junior Shepherd and his brother, Dana, played with a guy named Eugene Hutes, who started a band called Gogol Bordello.
Okay, you're losing me here.
Of course, back then they were called as Cossacks. So I digress, but it's Newfoundland.
Newfoundland.
One breath.
Yes.
And Newfie.
Got it. Okay. Well, thank you. And who is this? Man. Who's calling?
Timmy.
Timmy. Okay, hello. Timmy. Thank you, Timmy. I appreciate it. Okay, bye. So let's go back to from the frozen tundra up north to the humid swampland of Florida. We have this idiot who, you know, doubles as governor by the name of, I guess his given name was Ron DeSantis. Yes, I call him moron death sentence. Because this man is, although we have scientific evidence that vaccines help, that they will keep you from dying, they will most likely keep you from being hospitalized or getting horrifically sick, in most cases even keep you from getting the COVID, he refuses to mandate them. We have scientific evidence that masks, the proper masks, worn properly, protect both you and the people around you in both directions. You know, me wearing a mask will do more to, not that I'm infected, but it's really for the other people. He refuses to mandate masks. Our infection rate here in Florida continues to skyrocket. The hospitals are full. Kids are getting sick and dying in schools. Teachers are dying in schools. School workers, cafeteria workers, bus drivers. Within the first couple of weeks after the schools opened in Miami-Dade County, 13 employees of the Miami-Dade School District died, 4 of them teachers, all of COVID. And this moron not only will not mandate masks, he's got a rule against a mask mandate and says that he will dock any school district employees or school board members of their salary should they dare to, go along with this mandate. So that Joe Biden last week when he gave a speech said, these governors who are working against us, I don't understand it. I don't understand it either. But he said, we will make anybody who gets their salary docked for this whole. They'll pay it. Well, so death sentence had to double down again. You're never going to believe this, or maybe you will believe it. I use the word unbelievable all the time, but I have to strike that from my vocabulary because nothing, it's not unbelievable. It's totally believable. It's sickening, but it's totally believable. So what is DeSantis doing now? Now that the president has mandated that federal employees be vaccinated, that companies with more than 100 employees be vaccinated, employees who Joe Biden can mandate they get vaccinated, he's doing it. So what does death sentence do? Oh, you'll love this one. I'm going to let you hear it in his own words. All right, here we go.
And so if a government agency in the state of Florida forces a vaccine as a condition to employment, that violates Florida law. And
what?
You will face...
What?
And you will face a $5,000 fine for every single violation.
A $5,000 fine for every single violation? Let me share with you from the Miami Herald. Seriously, this just broke a little over an hour ago. Governor Moore on death sentence said Florida will fine local governments $5,000 for each employee who's required to be vaccinated, threatening some cities and counties with millions of dollars in penalties for adopting strict vaccine mandates. The mandates are in place to keep people alive. This moron is fine with thousands of Floridians getting sick each day and dying. During a Monday news conference in Gainesville, Death Sentence vowed to fight that city's requirement that employees be vaccinated by the end of the month or be fired. Death Sentence said, "We are not going to let people get fired because of the vaccine mandate. You just don't cast aside people who have been serving faithfully over this issue." What? Over what's basically a personal choice over their individual health. What the fuck? The result could be the state imposing millions of dollars in fines under a new state law barring Florida businesses and local governments from requiring proof of a vaccine, quote, to gain access to, entry upon, or service from the governmental entities' operations in this state. This new Department of Health rule enforcing the law is set to take effect this Thursday. Gainesville is Alachua County, which is already there. They were the first school district in Florida to say screw you to death sentence over his banning of a mask mandate. They put in the first mask mandate. Where I live, Broward County, put in the second. And these are the two counties that allegedly are now having their school board members docked of pay. So Miami Herald continues. It says Gainesville, Orange County, that's the Orlando area, and Leon County, which I believe is the Tallahassee area, have each passed requirements that employees be vaccinated or be fired, with exemptions for religious or medical reasons. Death Sentence noted that Orange County has thousands of employees, and he said that's millions and millions of dollars potentially in fines. So, am I wrong here? Why does he want to kill the people of Florida? Why does he want to kill citizens? I mean, you'd think he'd want to keep his followers alive so they could vote for him, right? There was another one. You know how I said, correct me when I'm wrong? Let me see if I can't find this because somehow I just did not save this video. Shoot. Do I still have it open on Twitter? He had an event with some idiot he brought up on the stage. Let me see if I can't find it. Here it is. Oh, this is just too good. So I don't even know who this guy is. It's just a little clip that's on the Twitters. But Kevin Kate, who is he's a TV person. I don't know what he does. He posted this quick video on Twitter. Of some guy, it says, moments ago, Governor DeSantis, or Death Sentence as I call him, let someone stand behind the seal of Florida and say, quote, the vaccine changes your RNA. No, it doesn't. Here's Death Sentence stands there while this guy, who knows who he is, says this.
The vaccine changes your RNA. So for me, that's a problem. So I'm here with you folks. We don't want to have the vaccine. It's about our freedom and liberty. It's not about the vaccine.
What the hell? They're taking away our freedoms. No, we're trying to keep you alive, you dumb shit. Trying to keep you alive. And as for it changes your RNA, no, it doesn't. I pulled up the CDC fact sheet on understanding mRNA vaccines. What the M in mRNA means is messenger. Messenger RNA vaccines. These are some of the first authorized for use in the U.S. They're the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines. And what they do, I shouldn't have to read this. It does no such thing. First of all, I don't even know what RNA is, except that it's like a single strand. And it doesn't change it at all. It allows a protein to be created. Here. First, COVID-19 mRNA vaccines are given in the upper arm muscle. Once the instructions are in the muscle cells, the instructions are, that's what the mRNA is. The messenger RNA is an instruction manual for your body to make this protein. The mRNA vaccines give instructions for our cells to make a harmless piece of what is called a spike protein. The spike protein is found on the surface of the virus that causes COVID-19. You're not being vaccinated with a live virus or even a dead virus, just something that gives instructions to your cells and how to create this protein. So once the instructions are inside the muscle cells, the cells use them to make the protein piece. After the protein piece is made, the cell breaks down the instructions and gets rid of them. Next, the cell displays the protein piece on its surface. Our immune systems recognize that the protein doesn't belong there and begin building an immune response and making antibodies, like what happens in natural infection against COVID-19. At the end of the process, our bodies have learned how to protect against future infection. The benefit of mRNA vaccines, like all vaccines, is those vaccinated gain this protection without ever having to risk the serious consequences of getting sick with COVID-19. The mRNA vaccine cannot give someone COVID-19. They do not use the live virus that carries COVID-19. They do not affect or interact with our DNA in any manner. It just doesn't happen. They're lying to you, and death sentence is letting some moron who doesn't have a clue about science stand up behind the state seal of Florida and spout off nonsense. Don't listen to them. I don't know why they want you to die. David, did you want to say something? Ribonucleic acid. That's what RNA is. Ribonucleic acid. There you go. The cell breaks down and gets rid of the mRNA soon after it's finished using the instructions. So for this idiot to say, it alters your RNA, stop it. Just fucking stop it.
I just need you to shut the fuck up because nobody asked you, bitch. I need you to shut the fuck up, bitch. Shut the fuck up, bitch. Just shut the fuck up, bitch.
Everybody's saying, bitch. Shut the fuck up. Shut the fuck up. Bow, bow.
Shut the fuck up.
Shut the fuck up. Bow, bow.
Shut the fuck up. Shut the fuck up.
Bow, bow. Okay. So to whoever that nameless idiot was. Okay. With that done, I think it's time to welcome Katrina Vandenhoevel back to the show. I'm so happy to welcome back to the program Katrina Vandenhoevel. She is the publisher of The Nation magazine and now editorial director, because you stepped down a couple of years ago now as editor.
After almost 25 years.
Wow.
A lot of news in that time, but I've never seen pace of news as we were talking about like this. I mean, it's just a wave every day. And we thought it was due to Trump.
Yeah.
And he's still in the backdrop, the kind of drumbeat of, how to put it, revving everyone up for his own purposes. But it's not what it was. But it is something different because they're just, you have a lot. It's interesting we have so many anniversaries, too, yeah. Because I think they do help people orient in some ways. And certainly younger generation, which hasn't really didn't live through it, but also hasn't really thought much about it in the last year.
True. You know, so we just passed the 20th anniversary of 9/11. And you and I think we're only about a month apart in age. I think you're a month older than I am. I'm November 4th. So we, you know, I have a daughter who's now 22. So she was a baby when 9/11 happened. I was living in Los Angeles, and my life was in flux at that time. I just adopted her. I actually adopted her from Kazakhstan. And we had just gotten home. She was 18 months old, so it was all new. My radio station, it was when the whole dot-com bust. My station was the first to go internet only. The dot-com bust happened. I was let go. So on 9/11, it hits. I don't have a radio station to go into for the first time in 20 years. And I'm thinking I'm leaving Los Angeles because the world is crazy and buildings are being attacked. And I wound up moving to Taos, New Mexico. But my daughter, who was not quite two yet, we talked about it the other night. And she, you know, I said, Allison, you were too young, so obviously you don't remember it. But what do you know about it? She goes, Mom, honestly, I don't know a whole lot other than they attacked a big office building in New York.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
Oh, that's why if she's reading now, and I know she is, you do begin to feel like you're almost at that time, because there's so much reflection. There's so much thinking about what we've learned, what we haven't learned. I have to say I was on 9/11. It was a beautiful day, as it was here on 9/11 the other day. Mm-hmm. And I went to work after voting for the first time. It was a primary.
Wow.
And I voted for Mark Green, who later lost to Bloomberg.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm crossing 14th Street. Our offices were at Irving Place and 15th. And I looked down University Place of people, and you could see the smoke and the white, like the debris that covered people for days, just suffocating people and people running. I went to the office. I had an office, and we sat in the conference room all day just watching the first tower I didn't see, but it had happened. And then the second tower, by the time I got to, and I, you know, part of what we had to do was, it sounds so old fashioned, we ripped up the magazine because we went to press the next day. So everyone's writing. And I think we struck a tone of, you know, just the anger, the grief, but justice, not vengeance, trying to think through what had happened to us, and a fear that there would be war fairly quickly because of the administration and their plans on the shelf. But also as editor, I had to kind of balance, there was a proportionality between personal grief and, you know, thinking of readers and how do you make sense for people. And I had been hijacked in 1978.
Oh, wow.
Going to visit my father, who was then in Geneva at the UN. I sat on the plane for 8 hours. I later wrote about it the next day for the Washington Post. But, you know, you have to remember there were people on those planes. I mean, the hijacking was part of, and we're learning now, some people were able to call through, others, it's not so clear. But that feeling of listening to some of the people who'd been hijacked was also. But we did a book called A Just Response. This is all of, I mean, we had everyone from Bill Moyers to Naomi Klein, mm-hmm. to Jonathan Schell, and just trying to make sense of it and trying to express a view that was not popular in wartime, to talk about Barbara Lee. She was an interview with Barbara Lee was in our first issue.
Wow.
After 9/11. Wow. And I mean, I respect her enormously. She had security detail, as you know, Nicole, for a
I
year.
Know. Because she dared to vote against, be the only voice in Congress in either chamber to say, no, I will not vote for the authorization of use of military force. And look how prescient she was, because 20 years later, they're still using that same AUMF to go in and bomb other countries.
In many parts. I know. And then Russell Feingold, to his credit, was one of the few, I think. I don't know if he was the sole vote against the Patriot Act, which people admitted they hadn't read. I mean, they, you know, it was just a signal that you were on board.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very hard in times of war to step back and say, and I was in New York. I mean, but I also think people around the country in some ways, I went to Kentucky with my husband the following year for Yom Kippur. And there was a surgeon from New York. And we agreed that those there in the town of Owensboro felt almost more kind of, you know, there was a feeling that they were full of grief and anger, and you know, wanted to share in a way that those in New York, I think, also, but were so close to it for so long. Mm. I'm just saying the country felt, because TV brought it.
Oh, yeah.
Those images. I mean, we're living with images. I mean, from Afghanistan in the last few weeks, the 9/11 images, which are played, you know, in a loop. And it's hard to not look at those images and feel anger.
Of course.
And feel like we want to help the women, or we, you know, and I think my view is, let's take the military money we were going to pump into Afghanistan in these next months and find ways to assist women and girls. What the military never, you know, militarization empowers the war parties. It doesn't empower, last I've checked, not many women and children.
Not at all. You know, there's so many different directions we can go in to talk about what happened over the last 20 years and its impact on us today. At The Nation, you put out a special edition called 20 Years of Bloodshed and Delusion. And it's, you know, there's so much there, but you talk about the women, and I'm wondering why in the last 20 years, why wasn't there a concerted effort to train women to pick up arms to defend themselves? Because I think they would have done a hell of a lot better job than the men have, who just the minute we left said, okay, we're done. That's what I mean. Kabul fell so quickly, it's because they weren't defending themselves. But I think the women would have.
I think women hold up half the sky, as I think it's a Chinese proverb. I think women were cut out of Afghan society, politics, and the economy in a way that would not have been that possible. But I also think, you know, in militarized times, women often don't fare that well because they have other ways of resolving conflict. Mm. Certainly what we saw was a Taliban or a nationalist force against an occupying foreign force, essentially, because the Afghan fighters, which we gave money to, you can hate the Taliban or you can, but they are fighting for what they think is their country and up against money, foreign money. But I mean, what happened, we still don't know, but the Biden administration believed, right, that the Afghan government would hold for months.
Right.
It did under the Soviets when they left. But, you know, the president leaves the country on a jet with gold in his bag.
With more money than they can put in the plane.
Right. Which shows you how weak the loyalty or nationalism, loyalty to your country and people is, because you're just jetting off. So I think there's a danger in I do think one thing we've learned is that we're not going to see occupation wars. We're going to see drone wars.
Yeah.
And one thing I do worry about, which is a little big, but it's real, is that the pivot now is going to be like to a Cold War with China.
Oh, God.
And it's not going to be counterinsurgency. It will be drone wars, but no occupation of countries like Iraq or Afghanistan. But the folly of a Cold War with China is something that needs to be, I think, better understood. And also, one thing that I feel is that we've seen in the last few years that, quote, ordinary people are probably wiser in some ways on entangling alliances abroad than the elite in Washington.
Oh, yeah.
You know, likes to go abroad in search of mission, and not the right way. I mean, I'm all for the climate accord. I'd like to see the Iran nuclear deal signed. But I mean, you're talking occupying, you're going into Africa and military. So I think there's some things learned about more restraint, a little more humility.
I hope so. Now, Katrina Vandenhoevel, you actually sit on the board of the Council on Foreign Relations. I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, I mean, I go once a year.
Okay.
But you know what I do? I write a column for The Washington Post.
Yes, you do.
The council has a wall, and you can post anything you've written if you're a member. So why not? You get my point of view. But the group that I have joined, and I often think of why the council, because I don't really participate. And it's a little less, I mean, there's some people on it who are very smart and radical. And then there's the larger group. But the Quincy Institute, have you
heard
of the Quincy?
Yes, I have. Institute? And that's Trita Parsi, right?
Trita Parsi, Edward-based Bush. And they've brought on some good people. And they're about realism of restraint and humility.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you know, there's a humanism, because I think realism can become too quickly the realpolitik, which is, but I find their work very compelling, and I hope to be more involved with them.
Oh,
and
good.
There's a group. Russia's not popular.
No. It,
I mean, I think anytime you have a cold war of China, Russia, those who get hurt are those who are journalists, feminists who I've worked with in Russia over the years. I worked there on a feminist newsletter. But I do think better dialogue than militarization. And so there's a group called the American Committee for U.S.-Russia Accord. But the people at Quincy, I think, have a right angle, which is, if you remember, Madeleine Albright said we are the indispensable nation. I want to believe that we are a great nation, that we have a lot of work to do at home. And I think that's part of the Quincy and the nation, what we believe. You'd be better to get your house in order, and that military misadventures abroad don't allow democracy to really work or thrive. I mean, we're seeing other pressures on democracy right now.
Sure.
But there are many. But one of them is militarization, which we see in the streets of our city, which we see at home, you know, coming into play. So there are links that I think people are making, and that's hopeful. So I take some hope. I'm an editorial director, so I wasn't as involved with the, I do believe that it's hard to find these days, but you have to give people a sense of what they can do, right? So that they can mobilize, even if it's something small,
mm-hmm.
because I think a lot of our media makes us spectators.
Oh yeah, but there's a new trend with, you know, I've been doing this for 40 years now, but a lot of people are finding they can do a podcast from their home through the computer. I mean, it's bringing a lot of civilian
energy
voices, if you will, right, to the fore. And I did something during the pandemic. I mean, I broadcast from my home studio, and I've been doing this for so long, but I always like to call around the world. When the Arab Spring started and the people were out in Tahrir Square, I called the hotels around it. But I always call hotels because you find people that speak English. And I got a guy at a hotel who was willing to talk to me as a human being. And during the pandemic, I'd call people in different countries to connect, because for the first time, I think ever in history, on a global scale, we're all experiencing the same thing. So I reached out. I spoke to people from Denmark to South Africa to New Zealand and Australia, all over the world, who were in the same boat we were. And the world gets a whole lot smaller. And I find that when regular people connect on a human scale, we don't have the differences that they do when the leaders talk. We can solve the problems if we reach out human being to human being, I think. Maybe it's naive, but...
Well, I did something like that the other day because of, you know, it's so strange to say that Siberia is burning.
I know, right?
And I called the editor of the Siberia Times, who speaks English. I mean, I speak some Russian, but it was to interview someone who's there,
yeah.
A person. I do think there's a humanity that gets stripped out of our coverage, too. And I'm always, you know, believing we should really talk to as many people as we can, because, you know, the nation can get a little lost in the...
Oh, yes.
Different kind of established. But I do think...
Oh, the nation, you're talking about the magazine. I'm talking about the country, but I get both. It works both ways.
But the nation can sometimes get... But I do think speaking to people, like, for example, what's going on in West Virginia.
Oh.
I mean, you know, there's... You want to speak to the people who don't have health care, who could use dental, vision care, who have families, who, you know, have diet. It's just, it's not radical. It's about putting something at the center of people's lives. All this talk about centrism and moderation, and then everyone gets hooked on the language, you know, without, but I do believe people, and I do think the citizen mobilization is great. I think Twitter is complicated. I do like Twitter. I use Twitter.
I do too.
For news, but I would not get in, as some of my colleagues do, into wars on Twitter.
I know. And I'm trying not to. I do, because I'm a fiery Scorpio and I lash out. And then I think that don't do that. So I try to pull back. But it gets to everybody. It just does. Right. But you brought up, you used to work two terms there, moderation and centrism or centrist. And I think we couch our words, because when you're talking about a Joe Manchin or a Kyrsten Sinema, there's nothing centrist or moderate about them. They are far right. They are, as my friend Howie Klein calls them, the Republican wing of the Democratic Party. I just call them conservadems, right? They're not centrist.
Or they're dinos.
or dinos. Right.
I did TV with Howard Dean the other day. I thought how he was credited with the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, but it was the, you remember Paul Wellstone?
Oh, of course.
That was the great senator from Minnesota, but he,
yes.
But I do think there's a quickness to latch on to the terms that a mainstream media, whatever that means, gives you.
Yeah. I won't call them moderates and I won't call them centrists. First of all, I don't think we have centrists anymore. In either party. But moderates is used for somebody who doesn't, you know, stand with the loudest voices in the party. That's not moderate. Joe Manchin is not a moderate. He's a radical right now, and he's preventing us from...
That's the worst part, the obstructionism.
Right.
I mean, what is the Mitch McConnell obstructing? But one thing, you know, it's hard to follow what's happening in Washington. Sometimes it's easier for the movements to, you know, understand movements. But, you know, Roosevelt, we talk about him, and Johnson.
Yes.
Had working majorities, which is why, you know, North Carolina was so important. But when you got one or two and you have a party that's a coalition party, got all kinds, it's hard.
But, and you know, I think John Nichols of The Nation was on the program last week, and we had a great discussion about, you know, Joe Biden is surprising all of us. I'm so pleasantly surprised. I didn't expect it. I was a Bernie Sanders supporter in both of the last two elections. And I voted. I voted for Hillary Clinton and I voted for Joe Biden because of the alternative. But I really didn't expect him to step up the way he has. And I think that's a great thing. He needs to, I don't know, mobilize. Right. I'm sorry.
He needs to get tough in a way.
He does. And he needs to invoke some LBJ energy. Lyndon Johnson would, I get he had more in Congress working with him, but he would make deals. He would sit Joe Manchin down in his office and say, you're gonna do this. You want a bridge in West Virginia? Or do you want health care for your people? Or, you know, he would make them do it. And I want to see a little bit of LBJ in Biden.
I think there's some of that going on. I mean, one hopes when he withdrew the ATF nominee, the tobacco, the NRA opposition, you hope that in that he got something out of Manchin.
Out of it, yes.
But it is the case you can do transactional deals to a good extent, and he should do some of that.
I also
think, by the way, he's a better president at this age than he would have been as a whippersnapper, you know, at 60. I think whippersnapper 62. but I do think the transactional piece is critical, but I do come back to when you have more comfortable margins, unless you're going to do something systemic like filibuster, really go for the, you know, which he's, you know, I think, and the courts, listen, I grew up in a family where we never called it court packing. We called it court reform.
Uh-huh.
And now everyone's on the case. So there's systemic things. Nicole, I worry deeply about what's going on in Arizona, Pennsylvania, to some extent, Wisconsin, maybe Florida, where they're contesting, the state legislatures are contesting the 2020 vote.
I know.
And so Democrats may win, but the delegitimization and the contesting of votes is worse than voter suppression almost, because it's going to linger.
And they're already doing this in California. The votes, the election day is until tomorrow, but they're already setting it up saying, well, if Gavin Newsom survives the recall, it's just because it was fixed. It was not fixed. They gaslight the country. And why the media does not just cut it off, just shut it down, because...
Well, you know, to be honest, Nicole, you said, and you were right, they're different media, right? there's, you know, Fox, there's CNN, there's MSNBC, and then there's local. I still think right-wing radio is more powerful than we understand.
I do, too. And so I come from radio, so I know it.
So, it, you know, you people getting, and then from the internet.
Yep.
And you got a lot of motion and a lot of disinformation and a lot of, you know, people who want to believe. It's a tough, in that sense, this country's resilient. It's been through tough times, but the media landscape. I mean, Roosevelt had Father Coughlin, you know, the right-wing radio preacher, but the dissemination was not as...
The internet is everywhere. And for the last 18 months, many of us have been at home. And people who maybe used to go out to work and didn't have 18 hours a day to spend online were all of a sudden online for 18 hours a day and being led down this rabbit hole thanks to places like Facebook and YouTube, who will keep feeding you more of that stuff. The more you look at it, the more they give you. And it plays
private corporate platforms.
Yeah, I know.
You know, it's not. So there need, I do take some heart also, though it's going to be hard, that Biden appointed some great antitrust people.
Yes. Oh,
antitrust
please.
Is not just business. It's about political power. But Lina Khan is someone who's
she's awesome.
For the nation, the prospect. Timothy Wu ran lieutenant governor with Zephyr Teachout in New York.
Yeah.
So, you know, the people, many of them are very good. The foreign policy is, you know, it's not Trump. But they're more establishment. They're more the blob.
Right.
But still.
Right. But you got Biden in there. But at least I have confidence that, right, he was opposed to the war. And I have confidence that he understands how the world works. He's been around long enough. Where with Trump, I didn't have confidence in anything. I don't think he ever read a newspaper. I don't think he ever read the Constitution. He never read a Bible. Not that I care, but, you know, he pretends he did. And so I don't feel like we're being lied to about everything. But we do face these enormous challenges. And unfortunately, I think the biggest one is dealing with the Voting Rights Act, with the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act and the For the People Act, and both of them have to pass. And right now we're at the stalemate. Without getting rid of the filibuster, they will not. And it looks like even if they do get Manchin on board, all we have is Lisa Murkowski from the Republicans. That's still...
This is where you really want a margin of some kind. You know, this is,
yes.
This is why 2022 needs to see a lot of mobilization. And this is why we haven't, I mean, we, the progressive community, hasn't paid enough attention to the systemic stuff in our democracy, whether it's filibuster or voting. I mean, listen, I remember 2000.
So do I.
Florida. I mean, my father said when he saw James Baker arrive and then Warren Christopher, he knew it was all over. But put that aside, because fighting, you know, but that was a coup. 537 votes.
Yep.
And then there were commissions set up, if you remember, voting commissions, Jimmy Carter. What happened? There hasn't been much change.
Nothing.
And it's kind of, but I, you know, keep hope alive.
There's a song written by a guy named Phil Roy that was popularized by Widespread Panic, and even Pop Staples did a version of it called Hope in a Hopeless World. And it goes through my mind. It's from 20 years ago, but I think of that. There's got to be some hope here, because we can't let them keep gaslighting us and keep winning when we're so close. We're right on the precipice of, as Bernie Sanders puts it, you know, life-changing legislation that would make life better in this country for so many people. Consequential. And, you know, one thing you point out, you have the columns in the Washington Post that are also posted in The Nation, and the most recent one, written as the pullout from Afghanistan was finalized on August 31st. The headline is, "It's clear America can afford Biden's investments at home. Just look at how much it spent on wars."
And also, just the pandemic, I did a column about tax the excess pandemic profits. These billionaires have, because, you know, this is also, not to be too much anniversary, it's the 10th anniversary this week of Occupy Wall Street.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
And the inequality and the wealth that has been accumulated in these pandemic times. And that is not going to be, I read today that they're not going to do much around the tax stuff. I mean, so that is, we know we can pay for.
Mm-hmm.
the investments in this country.
Well, look, Iraq, they're talking about the $3.5 trillion package, which I think is misleading because that's over 10 years. And they don't ever say over 10 years. So what if they were to say $350 billion per year for 10 years? We were spending $300 billion in Afghanistan every day. And you're telling us we can't do this in a year?
Every month.
To help us here at home?
I think one thing we hear even today is that many Americans believe we were paying that cost in order to be secure at home. I don't think it, I think we need to reimagine what security means in light of COVID.
Yeah.
But it means, you know, healthcare, it means childcare, it means valuing the old in our society and education and, you know, food insecurity. So there's a lot that would make us more secure. It's just that we don't define it. Climate.
Right.
I mean, these are issues, existential issues. And so, but there are no lost causes, only causes worth fighting for.
Well, and but there comes a point where, oh my God, do we have to keep fighting for the rest of our lives? I'm pretty much resigned that I am because I'm older. But I look at my kid and I think, I don't want to leave this world to her.
There was a story in the somewhere like Apple News the other day about people dropping off the grid. We may see more of that, you know. But
get an RV and just go.
I don't see it because I don't think I could live that way. I mean, everyone needs time to clear their head if you can do it, but you also want to be part of not just fighting, but
the solution. I hope. Yeah,
and I don't think there are any real solutions. I think there's always work to be done, but there's solution. I'm not sure. I mean, you can see Eric Foner, great historian. He spoke to us once about, you know, freedom. First of all, what freedom means to people. Freedom means, you know, economic security, or it means liberty, but it also means, you know, it's contested over decades. People fight for it and I do think you mentioned his name. One good, you know, Occupy. Bernie Sanders, we've been covering, I'm sure, for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
He was, you know, he would have been driven off the floor of the Congress 10 years ago, 12 years ago. And to hear him on TV, it's like, wow. No, that whole framework in the last 10 years.
It is amazing because 10 years ago, you know, now more than 10 years ago, I was interviewing Bernie on Air America. He used to be on Tom Hartman's show every week. But he was ours, right? And then all of a sudden, everybody got to know Bernie. And it's like, yes, now Bernie's mainstream, right? And his ideas are mainstream. The media and the right tries to paint him as radical, but Bernie Sanders is the mainstream now. And the rest of us, everybody's got to catch up because he wants to make things better. And so that's what gives me hope.
I'm a dissident, though. I'm a heretic at The Nation and my great colleague, John Nichols. I think Bernie could have run as a 21st century New Dealer on racial justice, on climate. The socialism piece, I think, scared off
a
constituency, you know, that might have come to him and not Trump.
If he had positioned himself as an FDR Democrat, trying to put forth a new deal, not just the Green New Deal, but a new deal for our times, I think that would have been it. But I'm here in South Florida where the Spanish language talk radio just went nuts on the socialist thing. And it's just
not Cuba, right? It's Venezuela.
It's all of it. It's all South America. It's some Cuba, but it's also South America. And they're all over down here. And they have this hardline impression of socialism without thinking of, you know, Denmark and the Netherlands.
No, you're right. No, but Bernie kept talking about Denmark in the first campaign. So Eric Foner wrote one night an email and said, does anyone have ties to Bernie Sanders? Can you please send him a letter and tell him enough with Denmark? he should retrieve his own country's radical history. So he wrote a short piece, which is true. The abolitionists, the suffragettes, the populists. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, so, we could keep going forever. Katrina Vandenhoevel, it's so nice to catch up with you. It's been too long. We should do this more often. I encourage people to check out the new issue of The Nation magazine. It's a big 20th anniversary issue. It's titled 20 Years of Bloodshed and Delusion. And also check out, Katrina, your columns weekly in The Washington Post, and follow you on Twitter at Katrina Nation. Thank you again for joining us.
Thank you very much, Nicole. It's been too long. I enjoy talking to you.
Me too.
And all power to your voice on these airwaves.
Thank you so much. Well, it is now. These are really the public airwaves because I don't have any big corporations behind me anymore. So at least, you know, that's the beauty of it. The bad part is it's hard to make a living. The good part is I can say whatever I want. Exactly. So I think I'll take that one. Thank you so much. Great to see you. Katrina Vandenhoevel at The Nation. She's just awesome. All right. With that, we're done. We're done for the day. And I guess, well, thanks for listening, everyone. I'll leave you with the news. I'll see you tomorrow. Jason Leopold will be here. Lots to talk about. Bye. Whoops. Would help if I push the right button.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The Senate is back in session Monday after a long summer break. The House returns next week, but the House Ways and Means Committee Monday morning released draft legislation for the budget resolution, which the Senate immediately begins marking up. The package includes a bunch of tax increases on high-income individuals, those making over $400,000 a year, raising the top individual tax rate from 37% to 39.6%. It also imposes a 3% surtax on individuals' incomes above $5 million. It raises the corporate tax rate from 21% up to 26.5%. That's less than Biden's proposed 28%, but higher than the 25% that Killjoy, Senator Joe Manchin, has said he's comfortable with. This legislation would also increase the top capital gains rate from 20% to 25%. This is the reconciliation package. The media keeps referring to it as the $3.5 trillion bill without mentioning that that's over 10 years. A more reasonable way to say it would be $350 billion a year for 10 years. Of course, both sides were making their case on the Sunday shows. Senator Manchin said he wouldn't back a $3.5 trillion bill.
He will not have my vote on 3.5, and Chuck knows that, and we've talked about this.
Aye. Of course, they didn't mention that this was already a compromise, down from $6 to $7 trillion when it first began. Senator Bernie Sanders, one of the chief architects of the bill, said that's not acceptable to the White House, to the overwhelming majority of the Democratic caucus, or the American people.
This is not Joe Manchin versus Bernie Sanders. I would surmise that over 90% of Democrats, over 40 Democrats in the Senate, would prefer to spend what I propose, $6 trillion, because they understand the needs facing working families and climate are so great. So a major compromise has already been made. And there is a real danger that this bill will lose, that the infrastructure bill will lose in the House, because you got many people there, and I support them, who are saying, you know what, we had a joint agreement. We're going to go forward together, deal physical infrastructure, deal with the needs of working families. Let's do it. Let's create the jobs. Let's deal with an expansion of Medicare. Let's deal with climate. That's what we've got to do.
Meanwhile, there's another issue simmering on the back burner that hasn't been talked about much, but the fiscal year ends on September 30th. That's just like 17 days away. That's the day the government will run out of money if no action is taken by then to fund it. The holdup is from an old issue that seems to only be an issue when Democrats are in power. That's the debt ceiling. To clarify, the debt ceiling is the total amount of money that the federal government can legally borrow. It's increased periodically to authorize the government to pay the bills Congress has already approved. It merely says that the U.S. will not default on the money it's already committed to spend. Now, during the former guy's reign, Democrats joined Republicans three times to raise the debt ceiling, and many even joined the Republicans to suspend it entirely back in 2019 with a vote of 67 to 28. Well, the suspension ended last week, and we're rapidly approaching the point where we'll start defaulting. But of course, Republicans are now balking, saying they won't raise the debt ceiling in conjunction with a continuing resolution to fund the government. It's like a broken record. By the way, for those who keep complaining about the national debt, it was just under $20 trillion when Donald Trump took office and more than $27 trillion when he left office earlier this year. Moving on to COVID, with the Delta variant raging around the country, President Biden addressed the nation Friday afternoon, rolling out a new six-pronged strategy to deal with the pandemic. Among them, vaccine mandates for federal workers, large employers, and healthcare workers. The pushback is exactly what you'd expect from a party who doesn't believe in science. I don't know. President Biden's campaigning with California Governor Gavin Newsom Monday as the polls closed Tuesday on the California governor recall race. Although the gap between the no and the yes votes on the recall continues widening, the right is regressing to their old trope of when you lose, you lie and claim victory anyway. The Trump campaign had their Stop the Steal strategy ready to go when he surprisingly beat Hillary Clinton in the electoral vote tally in 2016. So they put it away for 4 years and used it when he lost to Joe Biden in 2020. Well, now they're foreshadowing Newsom's victory by claiming this election was rigged too. You just can't make this stuff up. It's mind-boggling how many of their supporters are willing to suspend reality and believe this nonsense. He's back. North Korea is claiming that it successfully test-fired a new long-range cruise missile over the weekend. The announcement came as South Korea's top nuclear envoy heads to Japan on Monday to discuss North Korea with U.S. and Japanese officials. China's foreign minister is set to visit South Korea this week as well. And for some reason, the media has been fawning over Kim Jong-un's perceived weight loss. Seriously. As the Washington, D.C. and Capitol Police are bracing for another insurrectionist picnic at the Capitol, this one planned for this Saturday, September 18th, U.S. Capitol Police recommended six of its officers face disciplinary action because of their behavior on January 6th. For a range of offenses, including unbecoming conduct, failure to comply with directives, improper remarks, and improper release of information. The police agency said those officers' actions should not diminish the heroic efforts of others on the force. And now they're bracing for whatever this weekend will bring. And finally, there's another White House tell-all coming, this one from an unexpected source, Stephanie Grisham. Is the former Trump White House press secretary, best known for never holding a press briefing, who before she ascended to that job was the first lady's chief of staff. Well, Grisham is now breaking her silence. And we learn that one of the reasons for her abrupt departure from the White House was the response from Melania Trump when on January 6th, Grisham sent her a note asking, "Do you want to tweet that peaceful protests are the right of every American, but there's no place for lawlessness and violence?" Melania Trump replied a minute later with a one-word answer, "No." Grisham resigned within hours of that exchange and apparently has a lot to say about the former first lady and the former guy and the administration. Grisham's book, ironically titled, "I'll Take Your Questions Now," will be released on October 5th. I got the and that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is fully listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.